Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the Summer Autumn Season 2023. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. In this session, Kate Murdoch discusses with Karen Brooks, Melissa Ashley, and Lauren Chater, midwives, storytellers, and witches, wise women in history.
Thank you everyone for joining us today for Midwives, Storytellers, and Witches, Wise Women in History. I'm Kate Murdoch, and I'll be talking with Karen Brooks, Lauren Chater, and Melissa Ashley about wise women and the challenges they faced in time periods where this was openly discouraged and often prevented to be ambitious and to make their way in the world. I'm going to start by introducing our panelists. Karen Brooks is an academic and author who has written over a dozen books, with her historical fiction, The Brewer's Tale, The Locksmith's Daughter, The Chocolate Maker's Wife, and The Darkest Shore, published to critical and popular acclaim here and internationally. Her latest novel, The Good Wife of Bath, is a retelling of Geoffrey Chaucer's lusty and much-married wife of Bath from the Canterbury Tales, and will be published in the USA and Canada and the UK in January 2022. Lauren Chater, she's an author of the historical novels The Lace Weaver and Gulliver's Wife, as well as The Baking Compendium, Well-Read Cookies, Beautiful Biscuits Inspired by Great Literature. In 2018, she was awarded a grant by the Nielma Sydney Literary Fund to travel to the Netherlands to research her third novel, The Winter Dress, inspired by a real 17th century gown found off the Dutch coast in 2014. She's currently completing her Masters of Cultural Heritage through Deakin University. Melissa Ashley is the author of historical fiction, The Bee and the Orange Tree and The Birdman's Wife, which won the Queensland Literary Awards Fiction Prize and the Nielsen's Booksellers Choice Award. She has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Queensland, and she has taught creative writing and poetry at universities, libraries, festivals, and writers' centres. So going back to our topic today, it wasn't just men themselves who put up barriers for women, but the bureaucracy and traditions that they constructed to try and ensure that women's lives were defined by marriage and child rearing. Yet many women pushed against these constraints in both overt and subtle ways. So we're going to look at this in a general sense, but also in terms of the wonderful novels these authors have created. I'll be asking a number of questions, both general and specific to their stories. And then at the end, 15 minutes from the end, we're going to open up to Q&A. So feel free to send your questions via the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen at any time as we speak. So I'm going to start with Karen Brooks. In The Good Wife of Bath, Eleanor is a brave and feisty heroine who charts her own course, using her wits and her head for business. In your research, were there any real-life women who inspired this characterisation? And how true to life was she, and was it rare for women to have this degree of autonomy and education?
Okay, thank you, Kate. Hi, everyone. She wasn't based on any specific one person. Of course, my source material was Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and I guess I had to look a little bit at his life and look who he would have encountered on a daily basis in the various roles he had, and he certainly would have encountered many women of different classes. He was part of, later in his life, of John Gaunt's household, so he would have been very familiar with, say, John Gaunt's wife and indeed his mistress, Catherine Swinford. And he was married to Catherine Swinford's sister himself, though they had a fairly interesting relationship, shall we say. Some historians claim that the wife was based probably on Edward III's mistress, Alice Perrers, but I have to, who too has been much maligned by history. She was, she's often regarded as someone who was quite salacious, unfaithful, greedy, grasping, to the point where there's quite an apocryphal story where on Edward III's deathbed, she snatched a very valuable ring off his finger and took off with it. And she got property through him and things like that. So in that sense, you can see some of those characteristics coming across in Chaucer's wife. I don't believe that the wife was based on Alice Perrers. I think he was like any writer. He drew on what he knew and what he saw to create characters. So in that sense, the wife was, an example of a type of woman. And there were some people that say she embodies all the negative characteristics and is quite a misogynist portrayal of womanhood at that time, that loud-mouthed, uncontrollable, a woman who's quite puts the men in their place, talks in a very knowledgeable way and has a rapacious sexual appetite. And yet on the other, she's also regarded as a proto-feminist, you know, someone who sort of stood up for women, staked a claim in a man's world. And so in that sense, she's every woman to me, because it's a myth to think that feminism, I guess in the sense we have it now, it's new, but women have always fought for their rights and fought for their own space in a man's world. So in that sense, she was very real to the time.
Yes. She's certainly knows her own mind, and I really love the way she just went for whatever it was that she wanted, just very single-minded. It was fantastic.
Thank you.
Marriage is depicted as a means for a wise woman to carve out a future. It's women's business, and it's a crucial decision that impacts their future in your novel. Can you talk about the different methods used by Godsibs and good friends, Alison and Eleanor, to have control over their lives?
Oh, okay. Yeah, so there's two main women in the book, and Eleanor is essentially the wife of Bath, and Alison starts off as a stepdaughter because Eleanor gets married at the age of 12 to a man who's 62, which was quite an interesting relationship to write, but was also not untypical of the time. A girl, what we now think of as a girl of 12, was considered a woman, and certainly once a girl reached menarche, she was considered sexually available as well and could procreate, of course. So in the sense of marriage was a way for a woman to become socially elevated. So they always looked for a man that had means, and that generally in that class of people meant a bit of land, if not a trade or a business. So I guess Eleanor finds herself, because she's a servant really in a manor house when we meet her. So her first relationship, she becomes the in charge of a household, but of course her stepdaughter is older than her, and they have quite a feisty relationship to start with, a lot of conflict to start with, until they find common ground, and they become very dear to each other. And I say to people, the real love story in that book is between Eleanor and Alison, and they stay together through her five marriages. And I'm not doing spoilers here, because if anyone knows the Canterbury Tales, they know the wife of Bath had five marriages. And in fact, when in the poem, she's on a pilgrimage, and presumably when she's talking to the pilgrims, this is in the Canterbury Tales, about her husband's, the fifth one's dead and she's on the search for a sixth. So again, she still saw marriage as a way to, keep her position within society. So, but in this sense, too, marriage also allowed women an autonomy and liberties that they didn't have as what was called a femme sole or a woman alone. And though, again, widow had a certain status too, but it wasn't quite as much as being married. So that's why I think women sought marriage as a means of gaining a bit of freedom, a bit of financial security, and to be accepted socially, because single women were seen as a threat too. And Alison quite happily became Eleanor's companion because she was protected under that umbrella of a household. because a household wasn't just immediate family. Household was servants, companions, godsibs, which is like a god sibling. So one that isn't necessary through a marriage or a blood relationship, but one that's acknowledged, I guess, in God's eyes, much as I guess some religions have god children. Yeah. I don't know if I'm answering your question quite
right. Wasn't it? That was a valid choice that Alison made too, to kind of, in some ways, keep some independence through that choice and have that very strong relationship with Eleanor. So
yes, and a lot of women did do that. Like they would say if they had a brother and the brother married, they might stay in the brother's household and choose not to get married. I think, again, marriage was a desirable outcome. It was certainly one that was pushed by society and the church. But there were quite a number of women, and you get it particularly in later diaries and letters and accounts, that were quite fearful of it because childbirth, and Lauren can talk really knowledgeably about this too, you know, childbirth was, the mortality rate was so high, and it's quite a scary thing to become pregnant. I don't know that it was always the joy-filled thing that many of us feel now. They were terrified because they weren't sure they were going to survive it. So, you know, it was a great option, or there was the nunnery, you know.
Yeah.
But certainly under the umbrella of household, Alison gets freedoms and is able to be, and autonomy, a great deal of autonomy.
I sense a slight bit of poignancy in her choice though too, that almost like she kind of wanted to have someone, but she made that decision at some point that wasn't going to be the way. Is that true? Or
I think it was a genuine sacrifice on her part, but I think she also felt that, why spoil a good thing? She genuinely loved Eleanor, and you know, it was that deep, deep abiding love that can't be transcended by a relationship with someone else. So she made a choice, and she helped her with the business. Like, she was a brilliant weaver.
She was more talented, wasn't she? Then
absolutely, she was the real skilled artisan. Yeah,
And I thought their relationship was beautiful.
So thank you. Yeah.
All right, now I'm going to move to Lauren now. In Gulliver's Wife, Mary Gulliver has established a degree of independence through midwifery, a profession which was closely guarded by an unofficial guild of women. Can you tell us about the origins and importance of midwifery at the time, and how this was one arena where women still wielded power and wisdom?
Yeah, thank you. It's a really good topic and something I'm really passionate about talking about. When I was researching for Gulliver's, I knew that I had to come up with a profession for Mary, because it's not made explicit in Gulliver's Travels what she exactly does. And I knew I needed to think of a way for her to support her family while Gulliver was away at sea, because he's just kind of a bit useless and can't send her money back, or can't support her and the children. She's got two children. As I was researching, I came across this book on the midwives of 17th century London, and it was a sort of a revelation, like a touchstone research book for me, because the midwives were actually very powerful. They had their own unofficial guild. They weren't, of course, allowed to use surgical instruments, because that was the domain of the male surgeons guild, and there's no way that they would have been admitted into the male guilds there, and so they kind of just formed their own guild and supported each other through training, and they had apprentices, and then there were senior midwives, and so you had to sort of work your way up the ranks, and you had to complete a certain number of births before you could move on to the sort of next level. But it was an incredibly important thing for women to be supported in childbirth, because as Karen said, it was an incredibly scary time for women. The mortality rate for both mothers and babies was so high that having that support person there who knew what they were doing and had seen it all before would have been incredibly comforting, I think, to women, especially first-time mothers. During that time. And so Mary is a sort of a senior midwife. She's done all her training when we meet her, and she's also very involved in all the families' lives in the neighbourhood, because men and women lived very separate lives. You know, just the very nature of their work and the kind of duties that they were expected to carry out. And, you know, women were expected to be at home and it was very domestic and they looked after the children. The men went off and did this sort of rough work at sea or down at the warehouses. And so with their lives being so segregated, I think that was the other unofficial role of the midwife, was to be a support person for the other women in her neighbourhood and keep an eye on them and keep an eye on the children and make sure that they were looked after medically, if not emotionally supported.
Well, she kind of takes it upon herself a little bit with the danger that's in the neighbourhood too, to kind of keep an eye on that, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does, because that was the other thing that midwives were expected to do. They were expected to give to testify in court and give evidence if there was a sexual assault, because they had seen, they knew women's anatomy and they could identify, you know, the signs of abuse. And so that was another pretty sort of grim role that they had to carry out.
Yeah, and she's enjoying her independence for such a long time before it's ripped away.
Yes, it's quite sad, isn't it? But raises the stakes, I think, a little bit. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So my next question, one of the things that stayed with me from the story was the complex and often fraught relationship between Mary and Bess. Mary wants Bess to be armed with knowledge about the dangers facing women and girls, but at the same time to remain innocent. So can you talk about their relationship and how it relates to the society at the time, and in particular to the challenges facing women and girls?
Yeah, so the sort of the guidelines for women and what was expected of them were pretty strict at the time in 17th century London. It was a very violent time, a very dangerous time. Women, you know, they could be raped, and even though we were just talking about that they could be testified, I mean, testifying in court, so many cases just, it wasn't even important. It was a blip on the radar for the constabulary and the establishment. And so women were sort of used as property. They were viewed as property. They were traded. There were wife markets where you could go trade your wife in for another one if you wanted to. And so it was a very difficult and dangerous time to be a woman. And I think Mary, being a mother, really struggles with that idea of giving her daughter this independence that she wants and craves and needs in order to grow up. But to protect her as well from the sort of terrible things that that could potentially harm her. And so one of the things that Gulliver has done is allowed these fantasies about a sort of a life at sea to develop unchecked, and Mary has let them go because Gulliver's disappeared. So she's thought that she doesn't have to sort of step in and set down the rules for Bess, and that Bess will just naturally forget about them. But then, of course, when Gulliver returns, all those fantasies flare again, and Bess is sort of carried away by her own ideas of going off to sea with her father and living this adventurous life that just would not have been possible for her. And so Mary's job is to tell her the truth and to help her to see a new path for herself, a realistic path. And I think that as mothers, that's something that we probably all struggle with our children. We all want to give them that independence, but we also want to guide them towards their own path that's suitable for them. So right. I was drawing on my own inspiration, my own family, my own daughter for that as well.
Yeah, and I think guiding her into midwifery is a safe path and is something that she can experience, that little bit of freedom but within the confines of that.
That's right.
Those women. So yeah, it's a process, isn't it, in the story?
Yeah.
It's gradually making her more making it possible.
And giving her the chance to discover her own talents as well, you know, and find out if she is good at something or not. Yeah.
Well, and that comes into the willful teen thing too, because you know, she can't be seen to be dogmatic or to be bossing her around or putting ideas too blatantly out.
That's right.
So I think it's it's a gentle exercise.
You have to exercise the art of subtlety where teenagers are concerned, I
think. Oh, that's great, thank you. So I'm going to move along to Melissa now. So in 17th century France, a wise woman didn't openly voice her opinions. So to what extent were fairy tales used by women writers to talk about injustice and their views on the patriarchy?
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, it's really interesting to talk about speech in the 17th century. This is the time of Louis XIV and the Ancien regime, and nobody could speak out against the king. He had absolute rule. So if you did want to speak, and by this I mean publish, you needed to publish anonymously, go to Frankfurt or Amsterdam and have your work smuggled back into the country and sort of sold under the counter, I guess. The only way to really get published above board was to have a privilege from the royal censor. And, you know, as everybody knows, fairy tales are a subversive text, and so they could be published and circulated in a way that didn't really threaten the Ancien regime. So fairy tales became popular in France in the 1690s. There was a real vogue for them, and this was after Louis XIV had reigned for quite some time, and it was after the period in his rule where there was a real celebration and flourishing of the arts and culture. And this was later on in his rule where he'd become very religious and he'd waged constant war and he'd almost bankrupted the country. He'd taken the power from the nobility. There were epidemics, there was lots of sickness and everything. And it was kind of into this socioeconomic atmosphere that fairy tales were first published by French women, and they were a critique of the status quo. But, you know, they were particularly critiquing women's situations. So women, as our other speakers have said, women had precarious, very prescribed lives during this time. And so in France, and women probably were married as young as 12, and they were married as young as 15, I know that. And they went from being the property of their parents to the property of their husband. They couldn't work. They couldn't divorce. The heroine of The Bee and the Orange Tree, Marie Catherine d'Aulnoy, was married when she was 15 to someone who was 30 years older than her. By the time she was 19, she'd had 4 children. And she couldn't divorce this man who was kind of spending all her money, who wasn't a very nice person. So out of this difficult situation for women, fairy tales grew, and fairy tales were an opportunity for them to critique the status quo. And I think Marie Catherine did this in two ways. So number one, fairy tales kind of used fantasy and the magical and the wondrous, and she had these incredible stories where you had a court that was all cats and you had frog armies and you had inanimate objects that spoke, and so they all replicated courtly life. But because they weren't human, they weren't as much of a threat, you know, as a more realist text. And so the way that she really was subversive and critiqued the status quo was to, in her fairy tales, reverse the gender roles. So she had heroines who were very intelligent and resourceful and cunning, and they had so much more agency in their lives than the women of the time. And then by the same token, her male characters, her princes and fathers and, Prince Charmings and so forth, were depicted very much as losing their power. They were old, they were frail, they were sick, they were silly and so forth. And so Marie Catherine, you know, cleverly and in perhaps a lighter way, you know, critiqued the patriarchy of the time in this way with fairy tales.
And it was arranged marriage. Did you say that was one of her main critiques?
Yes. Sorry if I missed. If I didn't say that, that was absolutely the issue, and something that Marie Catherine was pretty much the central theme of her writing. She was very passionate about critiquing that, because marriage was about moving money between families. Probably. You could never marry for love. Like if you ran away with your lover, you could be thrown into prison for that. So there was just no freedom of the individual in that society.
Yeah, it was incredibly rigid, and it must have been just so traumatic for so many women. And it was interesting too how in reversing the, female and male roles and having the heroines, you know, pursuing their love mm-hmm. interest in mm-hmm. stories and things like that, that she's really trying to empower or show women that they can be empowered in some way, that it's possible.
Oh, absolutely.
Must have given a lot of people hope at the time.
Yes, I think that that's what her fairy tales did. I imagine in her salons she had readers, and also when her fairy tales were published as well, she had readers and participants who were perhaps these young women about to be married or were women already married, and through fairy tales they could escape, I suppose, a life that they didn't have, they only had so much control over, and but then they could also, you know, have the entertaining escape, but then they could have like a little seed of rebellion planted and imagine a different life for themselves, even if it was off into the future.
And perhaps they had little small rebellions, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Domestic things that happened.
Yes, yes, yes.
Leaving a pin on the husband's chair. No, it's really amazing that she was doing that at the time. It's fantastic. My other question for you is about the ambiguity around Nicola Tiquet's guilt or innocence in the novel. So it seems like Baroness D'Aulnay is the only character who really supports her, yet her support is constrained by appearances. And can you talk to us about this conflict between supporting her friend, preserving her own reputation and that of her daughters, and how all these things intersect in the story?
So I discovered Murray Catherine and the French fairy tale writers when I was sort of doing a creative writing degree looking at fairy tales, and I'd never ever heard of the French fairy tale writers before. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. And I discovered that Murray Catherine had this big scandal in her life when she was 19. And that made me think, you know, maybe I could write about it one day. And then further down the track, I discovered the story of Madame Tiquet, who was a very good friend of Murray Catherine. And Madame Tiquet used to attend, Murray Catherine ran a literary salon where people listened to fairy tales and acted out Greek plays and so forth. So she attended her salons, and one day she came to Murray Catherine with a problem. She had a very abusive husband, and he was attacked, and Madame Tiquet was accused of hiring a hit out on him, and then she was arrested for that. Murray Catherine, being her friend, gave her some advice and spoke to her about it. And then the novel is kind of about how Murray Catherine and other people try to help Madame Tiquet escape what might be a prescribed fate, I suppose. And the tension for me was that Murray Catherine had a personal motivation, I suppose, to become involved in Madame Tiquet's story. And I guess we discover, you know, more about this as the story moves on. But I was really interested in the ambiguity, I suppose, of is Madame Tiquet guilty or is she innocent? And, you know, to look at, I suppose, the way men were treated in that society, say if they had an affair or there was kind of no recourse for them. And then if women, the way women were treated, if they slipped up, they were thrown into a convent, and treated very badly. So I was interested in that, in the sense that Madame Tiquet is kind of an exemplar, I suppose, of what might have happened to women. And then I guess I had, I don't know if I'm really answering the question, but I had Murray Catherine trying to help her in various ways. But, yeah, also she had to protect herself because she had this secret, and so she had to guard that this secret didn't come out and affect her own reputation and her own career. So I can't really say much more about that. That's sort of
That was a really interesting conflict within the narrative that, you know, that she felt so much guilt, I think, as it went along, and that she couldn't do more. And
yes.
It was quite touching. I don't want to go too far because I don't want to... spoilers, so I have to be careful. Yeah. But some of the actions that she actually, it was Angelina did something later towards the end, mm-hmm. and I found that really special and touching. Mm-hmm. They did what they could within those constraints. Yeah. So yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah, and so like the fairy tales, I think they had to do clandestine, secretive things in order to slip something in to help her or appease pain or you know, whatever it was.
Yeah, and that's right. And I think the fact that she was quite high up in the hierarchy and she was still treated so unfairly does give a picture of just how dire things were. Imagine if you were, you know, much further down, what the outcome would be. I mean, possibly not even a trial. I don't know what happened to those women.
Absolutely. And she was just the talk of the town, you know. She just became an object of speculation, and she it was as if she was, you know, no longer a person, I suppose. And
it was very sad. All right, now I'm going to move to some questions for you all. Just a moment. So in the periods depicted, so I'm going to actually start with Karen again for this one. In the periods depicted in your novels, there were many opinions and judgments about what being a wise woman entailed. In what ways do your women protagonists show wisdom, and how does this go against the common understanding of what would be wise decisions at the time?
Wow, what a question. Wisdom manifests in different ways, and I think sometimes what we would perceive as wise now was probably quite foolish, because the women put themselves at risk because they went against, you know, society's mores or what the patriarchy laid out for them. But I think that their wisdom, and I was saying this in a last session, basically comes across as inner strength, resilience and kindness. And we so often observe kindness as a weakness in society, whereas I think it's a real strength. And it's a strength to show it when others don't, because we're so often persuaded to work against our own best interests. And that's usually by those in power, because it serves them. So I think, and I'm thinking here particularly, I think of The Darker Shore, which was my Scottish novel, which was based on a true story about what fundamentally became the last witch hunt in Scotland, in that it actually wasn't quite, but it changed the laws. As a consequence of what happened, the dreadful thing that happened in this little tiny village, changed the laws. Now, those women were seen as wise because they spoke their mind. They were very knowledgeable in their craft, and that's one thing that all the women have in common. And I think like the fairy tale writers, the midwife Mary in Gulliver's Wife, they all are brilliant at what they do, and they learn how to work within and against the constraints of society. But what I think I also want to say, something that sort of answers that, but also harkens back to what we were talking about with the women. And I think that, and the way they're perceived by society and how they had to work against all these constraints, every period we've all written in, religion was so significant and people lived and breathed it. And it's hard for us in a society where we're so secular, particularly in Australia, to, I guess, wrap our head around that. But the women were regarded, and the church has a lot to answer for the way women were constructed in society and what justified their treatment as property, to be punished, you know, to have such diverse rules, whether you're a man or a woman, was because they were seen as responsible for the fall of mankind, you know, the eviction out of paradise. So all women were seen as being like carbon copies of Eve, and therefore we wore sin, and it was up to man to stop us sinning, whether it was if we spoke out about something, we were sinning. If we refused sex, we were sinning, you know, and so on and so on. It's hard to sort of talk about without really delving down deep. So I'm just doing it very superficially. But I think that, unfortunately, what happened with the wise women, they were often talking against these ideas because they weren't in women's best interests. And they spoke wisdom, but it was seen as anti-authoritarian and therefore deserving of punishment and silencing. So wise women were silenced in all sorts of ways. And Lauren already spoke about how the midwives, who knew what needed to be known, were overtaken by this guild of surgeons and banned from doing certain stuff because that was man's territory.
Incredible arrogance on the part of...
Absolutely. Yeah. And like even in The Good Wife of Bath, which is set in the 1300s, where you have these skilled weavers, they were, I don't want to do spoilers, but, you know, Eleanor and Alison are constantly fighting to stay in business, but they're not given the officialdom won't stamp them, if you like, and won't give them legitimacy. So they're constantly fighting against that too, because the guilds were male dominated. I mean, there were some guilds that admitted women, particularly later, but not then. So and I wrote 300 years before Lauren, and it's exactly the same thing happening 300 years later. So yeah. So again, I don't know that I've answered your question, because it's a tricky one with the it's such a subjective thing in all these times. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, just the frustration must have been so immense, like just not to even be able, like, you know, Eleanor's situation, for example, when she was trying to start again and, you know.
Just she was wiser than her husband's, you know, she had better business acumen, but she wasn't.
Couldn't even take a single step
just
to get there. And just, you know, it would have been absolutely infuriating.
Yeah, needing that male permission to proceed, like, yeah. Yeah, but again, too, there were also women who worked against other women, and you know, that's important to recognise too. And it still happens today that, you know, the myth of the sisterhood. You know,
well, I think they feel safe within those constraints. They're worried about what it might feel like to actually get beyond them and take. You know, I think that comes down to fear.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And when they saw another woman rising, it served their interest and ingratiated them with the patriarch if they pulled the women back too. Yeah, so, I mean, fear is the word that encapsulates why they did it, probably what their motivation was, the underlying
core. Now that you mentioned that it would have benefited them with the patriarchy, I think that ambition comes into it too, because maybe their situation would have been improved by going along and keeping quiet.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they didn't want other women doing, you know, raising their head above the parapet for fear of what it might do to them too. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Lauren, would you like to talk about it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think Karen raised some really good points, and I completely agree. I think, especially for midwives, they had done a huge amount of training and had a huge amount of experience, but they were always still, you know, looked down on. They were always second best to the medical guilds and the surgeons guilds, and they relied a lot on gaining permission from those guilds and from authority in order to carry out their duties. But it's interesting that what you were saying about the church, Karen, that the church also needed these women, because the midwives had the duty of baptizing infants before, if they passed away, before the church could arrive and baptize them, or, you know, because it was a couple of weeks before they were usually baptized. And so that was a very important role for midwives, because the church wanted those souls for themselves. They didn't want those souls going over to the Catholic. It was Protestant England, so they didn't want those souls going over to the Catholics. And so that they had to be invested. They were invested with this sort of power. But of course, with that power came a lot of restraints and constrictions. So women had to learn how to navigate and skillfully negotiate those power plays with people like bishops and you know, people who had really a lot of power when you think about it. And the fact that they managed to do that is extraordinary, I think. And we look back now and we have wills and what they left each other, and we don't have a lot of actual sort of first-hand accounts or a lot of their own words. But so we have to read between the lines, and we can only assume that they must have been very intelligent, smart women to be able to get through their lives maintaining these relationships with important men in order to protect their sisterhood and their children and their daughters and their friends, I think. So
yeah, there's a crucial scene in Gulliver's Wife where Mary does exactly that, and, you know, has that meeting. Is it with the bishop?
With the bishop. Yeah.
Yeah, and that would have taken, you know, something like that would take enormous courage and strength. Yeah. Because, you know, she's not hugely. She's educated in midwifery, but in terms of general.
Oh, yeah, she's a commoner, you know.
I think that was very daunting, very intimidating.
It would have been.
That part of the story for her. And, yeah, I'm sure that would have been replicated with lots and lots of women in London at that time.
Absolutely.
Maybe not that exact scene, but that kind of.
No. But definitely there are examples where the midwives took control. Like there was a story in there about a midwife who protected a woman who was in labor and her husband was beating her to death, you know, and she stood up to him and said, if you don't desist, I will bring the power of 12 men upon your head. And he stopped, you know, and left his partner alone. And so these women obviously did have some kind of power. They had to learn how to use it properly without endangering themselves. So I think the records are there. We just have to read between the lines. That's all.
Well, it is a fine line because, you know, between being assertive and actually putting yourself in physical danger. So I think you know, that makes it all the more courageous in that sense.
True.
Melissa, would you like to add to the your thoughts on it?
I've sort of put Murray Catherine, seen her as a bit of a wise woman in the sense that the fairy tales came out of the literary salons that women ran, and they were usually the hostesses of them because they were seen to have this sort of special talent to facilitate conversation and conviviality and so forth. And Murray Catherine, through her salons, I think provided a safe space for other women. You had the audience of the salon, but you also actually had other female writers who went to the salons and could actually participate in a literary life. So they were really quite interesting, I think, in a way very modern. We still do these things. In the salons you could, people wrote together, they did all sorts of exercises, I suppose. You could write a poem, they dressed up as characters out of Greek myth, they acted out plays, and they also recited fairy tales. But something else that they did was circulate manuscripts. And so you would critique the manuscript and hand it back and perhaps go and recite the fairy tale again at the next salon. And eventually that led to publication. So I think what was very clever about Marie Catherine was just this, and she's not the only one, there were other French female fairy tale writers as well, but was the service that she, service is probably the wrong word, but the space she created for women writers and creatives in that cultural epoch to express themselves, but also it's not just that, it's to create a community where they were sharing each other's work, they were goading each other on, they were learning from each other, they were competing with each other, and so they created a movement. And then I suppose the other way that she acted as a wise woman was dipped on it before, but was just to open a space for the readers, which is quite different again, but just to have, you know, imagine a different outcome for themselves perhaps, or, you know, turn the gender role on its side.
And also it's the expression of the mind, which was something that wasn't so prevalent, you know, that women were encouraged to express themselves by decorating themselves or having children or who they marry. And so this is an area where, you know, they didn't have as much opportunity. So, I mean, that in itself was quite a powerful act to have these salons.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So my next question for all of you is...
Sorry, can I just add something? Because I was first to answer it, and because Melissa and Lauren have said such wonderful things, and you too, I think what makes a lot of these women wise and my characters, but what you're talking about, that fine line, and what Lauren was saying, and it's the fine line between being perceived as a threat by the society, patriarchal society, and therefore being need to be brought down, and being perceived as an ally. And I think the women were constantly negotiating that fine line, and they did it brilliantly, whether it was negotiating with bishops, writing subversive fairy tales, or well, my good wife's not always wise. She does make some really foolish choices and bad choices, but the other women in the other books, not so much. So I think it's constantly negotiating, this constant negotiation. It must have been exhausting.
Absolutely.
Why do we still do it? We still do it to a degree. Sorry, I had to add that.
Well, almost being apologising for oneself, but, you know, but being sort of very subtly assertive at the same time. But I think women do still do that. Honestly, maybe not to the same degree, but yeah, sad to say, it's a thing. So my next question is, can you tell me about the ways in which your women characters are able to achieve their objectives in a male-dominated society, and what are the benefits and drawbacks of their actions? It's a little bit related to the previous question. So, Karen, would you like to start?
I always think of the good stuff after the other two have spoken.
Can you come back to you?
Can you come back to me? Yeah, thank you.
Lauren?
How do they navigate? How do they negotiate? Or
well, how do they achieve their objectives?
How do they achieve their objectives? Okay.
Yeah, and what are the benefits and drawbacks of the way they went about that?
Sure. So how do they achieve their objectives? I don't know that they necessarily set out with a plan to sort of, take over or take control of this. I think sometimes things just happen, and what defines these women as courageous and amazing are the fact that they can just adapt. So adaptability is a huge strength, I think, for these women, right? Their ability to sort of read a room or read a situation and turn things around so that it benefits their sisterhood or their guild or whatever it is that their objectives are. That's really the defining characteristic and what makes them such interesting, I think, characters, and that you want to follow them and read about them. And your fairy tale writer, she's just an incredible sort of light in the court and in this place where everything's sort of dark and dangerous. I guess having that ability to change things and adapt is what really defines these women.
Than actually achieving things.
And then it's not until you look back that, with hindsight, that you think, oh, you know, I have actually done that. And I think that's true for a lot of women. We're constantly reinventing ourselves, and it's a transitional phase. It's difficult. And it's not until we look back on our achievements and we go, oh my God, I can't believe, I did that. I can't believe that was me a lot of the time. Yeah.
Incremental process. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an incremental process. It's not something that you set out to do. And I think that's true to life.
Which can make it even more of an achievement in a way that
absolutely
on you and you're not quite expecting.
Yeah. If you were told from your birth that you were an amazing woman, you were perfect, and that's, you're just setting yourself up for failure, really, or setting your child up for failure. And so it's those things that we look back on, really, that define us.
Now, we're getting a bit close to question time now. So do you just want to quickly add something, Melissa, before we go to questions?
Like Lauren, I didn't really see them as having objectives. It was more something that incrementally unfolded as well. So that's a women's writing, I suppose, in 17th century France. And in the beginning, early in Louis XIV's reign, there were female novelists that became very popular. And out of the female novelists, I think, grew the fairy tale writers. And just very quickly, during the early arts flourishing phase of Louis XIV, you had this tension between the modern and the ancient writers, and the women were put into the modern writers because they kind of had a more vernacular language. Men were more traditional because they were taught Latin and Greek and they studied the myths. And so there was this tension between two types and even philosophical arguments between them. But into that, like, women slipped into the gap there, and they actually had a literary tradition that, grew and developed and changed over time, and then unfortunately kind of went to sleep and we've all forgotten about it. And even male writers took some credit for the development of the novel, for example, but women in France did actually contribute to that, but that's another forgotten story.
Yes, well, they were very progressive. I'm curious, it's a pity we don't have more time, because I'd be curious to know what actually made it slow down and stop. But anyway, do you have anything to add, Karen, before we go to questions?
Just really quickly, I love what both Lauren and Melissa have said, and all I'd add in terms of talking about my character is that she uses sex and she's quite manipulative, and she recognises weaknesses and strengths, and she either uses weaknesses against people or turns them into strengths and helps them become stronger and better. And not always to her own advantage, though. And so that's what I'd say. And I think, a lot of the women pander to the male ego as well. And it doesn't mean they always achieve what they want to, but, yeah, they learn those sort of quite manipulative measures as well. Yeah.
Yes.
That's all I'd add. Yeah.
She was very good.
Yeah, but adaptability is a great word, and I really like that Lauren said. I thought that was wonderful. Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. So we've got a couple of questions here. Just have a look. Okay, so I'm just trying to think which panelist to address this to. Okay, I'm going to ask Lauren. What point of view do you prefer to use in terms of narration, and what challenges have you faced with this?
I think it really depends on the story that needs to be told. For me, I assume they're talking, I assume that the person asking the question means point of view, a character point of view, not sort of so. A narration. Yeah. I use my gut instinct a lot when I'm writing first drafts to see if there's any sort of other voices that come in, and I just leave myself hopefully open to those other voices. I think it really depends on the story. And for this Gulliver's one, I sort of always had Bess in my mind, at the back of my head, just sort of waiting in the wings to come in. And so when Mary's section was finished, you know, their Bess was just there. So for me, that's how it usually works. I just work on instinct, and then I'll read it back through, obviously, and in subsequent drafts we'll go through it and check and see if it's working or not, and if it might need to be shifted. But usually it does. It just works out, I think.
Yeah, well, it'd be a pretty major edit if it doesn't, hey?
Yeah, exactly. Kill me, please.
Try and get it right the first time.
Exactly.
I've got another question for all of you. Someone would like to hear about your writing processes and your writing craft. So, Karen, would you like to start with that?
Sure. I guess in terms of writing process or craft, how we tackle it each day, I guess, or the research, and basically have the idea, I guess, in the general overall sense, have the idea, do the research, write a quite detailed timeline, and then the daily craft, I guess, of writing is I try to set myself a word goal each day, and I do treat writing like a business. I take it very seriously. I sit down, I'm in my home, in my study, but I go to work, you know, to 6 to 8 hours a day, and some days it's blood, sweat and tears and like squeezing toothpaste out of an empty tube. And other days I get in the zone and I'm delighted by how much I've written. And the next day I go back and edit what I wrote the day before and keep the story flowing forward. At least that's in principle the ideal. And some days I think, what crap I wrote, and end up deleting it. But that's sort of the daily thing. And I have a ritual where I light candles. Actually, that's one of my little candle holders there, isn't it cute? And scented candles, and I listen to the music of the era as I write. So that's literally my writing process, if that's what Shell meant. Yeah. Oh, is it? No, Marianne meant. Yeah. That's.
What about you, Melissa? Oh, you're on mute. You're on mute.
Sorry about that. I think for me, I need the idea first, and I often sort of have an idea for quite a long period of time, or more a person and a person, a character and a historical period, and then I sort of gather research about that, and I need to think about it for quite some time as to whether or not it's big enough for me to write about. My writing process, I absolutely love research, so it involves probably far too much research, and lots of filing and note taking, and I make mood boards and all sorts of things. I've got a very visual imagination, and then I'm finishing a first draft at the moment, and I'm quite slow with my writing. I wish I was faster. So it's a day-to-day job for me as well. I write every day in the morning, and I have my rituals. And I just treat it like that. And yes, some days are rather challenging, and other days it comes more easily. But I wish I wrote my first drafts more quickly.
Well, you can, if it's paced out, you can enjoy it though too. It's a benefit.
And there's deadlines, so.
Yes.
Yes.
That is deadlines.
So I'm thinking we might, we're about 5 minutes to the end and there aren't any other questions. So I thought I'd ask my final question for all of you. How has the fact that men have written history affected the portrayal of women's lives? And how does this drive and impact your work as novelists?
It's a good question, isn't it? I think hopefully there's been a bit of a revolution in the last couple of years with the Me Too movement and women wanting to seeking out women's stories, their own versions of those stories, because of course, history is always written by the ones in charge, and a lot of women's history has been sort of a revisionist. And definitely when I was reading some of the research for Gulliver's, like there was midwifery books, manuals that were all written by men. But they'd never actually seen a birth. and so one of the books that I was my touchstone during the research was the midwife's book, or The Whole Art of Midwifery, discovered by Jane Sharp. And she was the first English woman to write a midwifery manual. And she knew, you know, when you read it, you can tell that she's actually seen a birth and she knows women's anatomy, that sort of thing. So I think it has been going on for a while, just sort of under the surface, but the last couple of years it's just sort of exploded. And I think it's really important for us to be able to find and publish, and for people to publish women's stories in their own words, as well as this sort of novelist stuff that we do, where we're bringing those stories hopefully into the light and people can then do their own research and learn more about the sort of women who inspired those stories.
Absolutely. Karen, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, revisionist history has now been around for quite some time. You know, I mean, if you round the 1960s, if not earlier, women historians started to really delve and look into diaries in the everyday. We've always had the nobility, the big important dates, you know, the people in power, and it was often the men, well, it was always the men that wrote the history. So if you think about that, you've got 50% at least of the population, their narratives, their stories missing. Mm-hmm. And then reconsider that and you've got all the ordinary people, the uneducated or the mildly educated, the illiterate, the trades, all those are just missing from history. And it's lovely that we're going back. And as Lauren said, whether it's fiction or not, and it's in those gaps and omissions that we as fiction writers, historical fiction writers, find these incredible stories. And then when you start to do the research, you find a bit more. I said in my last session, it's where we put creative flesh on history's dry bones, you know, and it's really important to do that. And I think to have the female point of view doesn't mean that we erase men from history. It means we put ourselves back alongside the men where we've always been and where we belong. And now we get a much more wholesome, fuller picture of history by doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just incredibly important. And it's a shame it didn't start sooner.
Absolutely.
It's definitely almost a movement that's happened with, you know, authors finding these forgotten stories and these women who are essentially silenced or just forgotten. And yes, and bringing them to life. Yes. Melissa, would you like to add to that?
I think that, so Murray Catherine and Elizabeth Gould, who was the heroine of my first novel, both kind of had fame and reputations and kudos in their own lives, and both of them had a really interesting historiography, I suppose, in that after they died, you know, their contributions to science or the arts were still known, but then over time they were forgotten, and the reasons for them being forgotten or being suppressed are actually always quite complicated. So there's a complicated historiography in terms of perhaps somebody taking their ideas or a movement deciding that, you know, this is a woman's voice or this is a woman's art form and it's not as valuable as a male one. But I just find it really interesting that the historiography of why someone has been forgotten isn't ever a black and white thing, and women were often celebrated in their lifetimes and women always, you know, contributed to every single aspect of life. And that's, I think we forget that sometimes. Like, we really think that history is very is very one-sided, but it's not at all. And so it's imperative that we dig these stories out, and as fiction writers we're obviously imagining parts of them, but there is a big movement and a readership ready to take it in as well. So it's very exciting.
It is, isn't it? I'd like to thank you all so much for your thoughts and insights today. It has been really wonderful discussion, and you're about to finish up now and get cut off. So thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Elizabeth. And thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.